This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you ever take a trip to Ireland in October, you may see hundreds of people gather for a walk to a bridge in Dublin that celebrates Hamilton. No, not that Hamilton. He's Ireland's greatest mathematician.
Mathematicians were stunned at his audacity to create such a system of numbers, but they eventually came on board.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about William Rowan Hamilton, the man who vandalized Broome Bridge with an equation which changed mathematics forever. We'll also hear how virtual reality is being used to teach history, celebrate the teenager who gave the world Frankenstein, and we'll spend an academic minute advocating for your hosta. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. October 16th is a very special date over in Dublin. That's when they commemorate the day a mathematician vandalized a bridge, invented quaternions, and changed mathematics forever. Samuel Hansen has the story.
It's a clear, sunny day in Dublin. I'm strolling along the banks of the Royal Canal on my way to visit the site of the most important mathematical moment in Ireland's history. And I'm not alone. I'm making this trek with a couple of hundred other people, mathematicians, school children, local community members. We're on our way to Broome Bridge because on this day, October 16th, back in 1843, William Rowan Hamilton vandalized Broome Bridge with an equation that changed mathematics forever. Fiacra Ocabra is a senior lecturer at Maynooth University and organizer of the Walk to Honor Hamilton.
He was called the Liberator of Algebra because he liberated algebra from arithmetic. Mathematicians were stunned at his audacity to create such a system of numbers, but they eventually came on board, and it opened up a whole new landscape of mathematics where mathematicians now could feel free to create all sorts of new structures.
The equation that Hamilton scratched on the bridge read I squared equals J squared equals K squared equals IJK equals negative 1. That certainly is a mouthful, but it introduced a new type of numbers to the world. Hamilton called them the quaternions. And they have all kinds of applications. But before we get to that, a little bit about the man that brought them to us. William Rowan Hamilton was born in 1805, and by age 22, he was appointed Royal Astronomer of Ireland before he even graduated from Trinity College Dublin. As Royal Astronomer, Hamilton actually devoted most of his time to physics and mathematics, and there was one problem which particularly vexed him: extending complex numbers from two parts to three. Complex numbers had been around for nearly 300 years. They're called complex not because they're complicated, but because they have two parts. You get a complex number when you add a real number, say 2 or negative 10, to an imaginary number, a number that when you multiply it by itself, you get a negative result. For example, 2 plus 3i. 2 is the real part, and 3i, the imaginary part. That may sound rather convoluted, but the point is, complex numbers are extremely useful. These complex or two-part numbers allow mathematicians to do calculations on points in two-dimensional space. But Hamilton? He wanted to create a three-part number system which would allow for calculations in three-dimensional space, basically allowing mathematicians to work not just in 2D, but in 3D as well. He worked on this for more than a decade, and his wondrous new three-part number system, it worked for addition and subtraction. But no matter what he did, no matter what he tried, he could not get these three-part numbers to multiply and divide. And without that, his new number system was a failure. Then one day, while walking along the Royal Canal of Dublin with his wife, Hamilton realized he had been thinking too small. What if instead of a three-part number system, he tried four-part numbers? Here is Fiacra reading Hamilton's own account of what happened. This is from a letter to his son.
Although your mother talked with me now and then, yet an undercurrent of thought was going on in my mind, which gave at last a result whereof it is not too much to say that I felt at once an importance. An electric current seemed to close and a spark flashed forth, the herald, as I foresaw immediately, of many long years to come of definitely directed thought and work. Nor could I resist the impulse, unphilosophical as it may have been, to cut with a knife on a stone of Broombridge as we passed it, the fundamental formula.
That's right. He scratched his new formula into the stone of Broombridge with his knife. Hamilton now had his new system of numbers. Just instead of having three parts, they had four, which is why he called them quaternions. And while he was sure these quaternions were important, other mathematicians didn't come around as quickly. A lot of their misgivings come down to how quaternions act when multiplied together. If you take one quaternion A and multiply it by another quaternion B, the result is not necessarily the same as B times A. In the parlance of mathematics, when you multiply them, quaternions are not commutative. In other words, the order in which you multiply them changes the outcome. Fiacres says if mathematicians had just looked at the real world, they would have seen plenty of very illustrative examples where commutativity also doesn't hold.
I don't recommend you do this, but if you take an empty swimming pool, take the two operations of filling it up with water or diving in head first. If you reverse the operations, you get slightly different results, I think.
This idea that a number system doesn't need to require multiplication or any operation to be commutative was huge. It earned Hamilton his title as the liberator of algebra, because it opened the door for mathematicians to experiment with even more radical departures from the norm. If this was the only thing that came from quaternions, they would still be an enormous deal. But quaternions have many practical uses. In fact, they're so useful in calculating three-dimensional rotations, they've become integral to space travel.
Apollo 11 landing on the moon wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for quaternions. Buzz Aldrin has said that himself when he came to Ireland and was walking around Trinity College. Apparently somebody told me he was quite bored for a lot of the time looking at all these famous busts and people's heads. And when he came up to Hamilton, he lit up and he said, basically, we would not have gone to the moon if it wasn't for that guy.
This talent for rotations also makes quaternions critical for computer graphics. They've had a hand in animating everything from video game characters like Lara Croft to Pixar movies. If you ask me, that's work worth celebrating.
I often thought if he made it up, he couldn't have made it any easier to commemorate.
Mathematics is not exactly a practice that leaves a lot of physical artifacts behind. But in the case of quaternions, all you have to do is go to Dunsink Observatory and retrace Hamilton's walk to Broombridge to relive Hamilton's achievement, which is exactly what Tony O'Farrell understood. He's professor emeritus at Maynooth University and the founder of the Hamilton Walk.
We have the bridge. It's more or less as it was. We have the place, and so we can actually celebrate it on the spot. That's the special thing about this.
I talked to O'Farrell during the 2015 Hamilton Walk. He led the very first one in 1990. He'd been thinking about all the emphasis people put on the literary side of Ireland, in particular, Bloomsday, an annual celebration on June 16th of the author James Joyce. And O'Farrell, he thought that Hamilton deserved the same sort of attention.
Hamilton's name was not a household name in this country. And so I thought the 16th of October would be a good counterpart to the 16th of June.
And the walk has gone from only a couple dozen participants back in 1990 to hundreds every year. And it's clear that Hamilton is important to Ireland. People here are proud of him.
Pretty safe to say he was the greatest mathematician in the history of Ireland.
It's just, well, he's a very famous Irishman, scientist, mathematician, and he was a genius up there with Leonardo da Vinci, so we're really coming out to honour one of our own.
The Hamilton Walk to Broombridge happens in Cabra, a working-class neighbourhood in Dublin. Every year, the locals put up banners and provide refreshments for the walk's participants. Their new rail stop will even bear Hamilton's name. And according to Liam O'Neill of the Cabra Community Council, the community is embracing Hamilton's legacy.
The impression from the local community, who is Hamilton? Okay. But now the majority of them know who he is. But it also made pupils more aware of mathematicians and science. And there are many, many schools in this area which give superb facilities, and children have an option of going on to greater education, which they have done in their droves. And it's great that Hamilton has been one of the forerunners, and they can identify with Hamilton and with mathematicians.
It's an impressive legacy for any mathematician. One Cabra resident, a guy named Jack Gannon, has even memorialized Hamilton's work in song. I asked my friend Jess to sing it.
And then one day on Broombridge Stone, he carved a great sensation.
Mathematics isn't an off-celebrated subject. Sure, we learn it in school, but rarely do people stand up to sing its praises. This was perhaps the most interesting thing about the Hamilton Walk. There I was among a couple hundred people, all gathered together to celebrate an achievement in mathematics, to celebrate Quaternion's birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to Quaternion.
So if you find yourself in Dublin on October 16th, join in on the celebration. You won't regret it. At the very least, it's a fine walk along a canal with great company. Plus, when else in life do you get to sing the praises of an equation?
Hi-ho, Hamilton Road.
I'm Samuel Hansen. This production is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
It had to be Quaternion equations.
All right, let's head back to this side of the Atlantic and talk about a different kind of history observation. Could a history lecture be enhanced by allowing students to virtually experience a moment in time? Faculty at Williams College in Western Massachusetts say yes. The best of our knowledge is Jim Lavoulis reports.
And now we put some headphones on you, and you probably won't be able to hear me
okay. After
that point, so I'll shout at you.
Okay.
I completely lost track of where Williams College professor Morgan McGuire was after he strapped me into what are basically ski goggles and headphones that entirely covered my ears. Instead of standing in a square gray room inside a library, I was in some sort of high-tech robot world.
Hidden in that room are two things that look like little wall speakers, and those are these, they're called lighthouses, but they're basically these little laser beacons, and it's constantly sweeping the room with sort of a radar-like sweep. And because there's two of them, it can use that to triangulate exactly where your head and your hands are. And so that's how the system knows that when you move your head, it has to rotate the world in the opposite direction to make it seem like it's staying put.
Using two controllers with buttons allowing me to virtually grab things in this game world, I was tested on repairing a robot before it self-destructed. I failed and was quickly sent back to the square gray room.
Thank you for your participation.
That's a recording. He has to say that.
That was wild. I mean, I think my heart rate was up. Definitely.
So I think the line from the Matrix is something like, you know, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
McGuire is an associate professor of computer science at Williams who has contributed to video game franchises such as Call of Duty and Marvel Ultimate Alliance. He says part of what makes VR so realistic is low latency.
The goal is to be around 10 milliseconds of latency. So that's 10,000th of a second is the delay between when you move your hand and when your hand has to move in virtual reality. It's technically impossible to achieve that today. We're somewhere around 50 to 60 milliseconds, but there are a lot of clever tricks we can do to predict things. So you can't move your hand instantaneously. When you start moving your hand or your head, we can predict, well, you can only accelerate so fast. If you've started moving your head, it's going to keep moving for a little while, and I can predict where you'll be at the end of that movement.
McGuire has been working with students and faculty in other departments to see how virtual reality can be the next big thing in film, or if it can create experiences to enhance the understanding of history.
So I just put you in an experience where I took you to this science fiction laboratory, and to some extent I hope it felt like you were really there. And your memories of that place should be very different than if you played a video game or you saw a movie in terms of your remembering being there and the sensations of what are being there, the sounds that you hear around you, the things you see. And there's a level of exploration you can get into because of the interactivity and the embodiment where if it was the Colosseum, you could pick up individual rocks, you could look behind things, you could do all kinds of things that you're not going to get from, say, you know, a really well-produced documentary.
This past summer, Williams put on a virtual reality hackathon with professionals from the video game company Activision, which has an office in Albany.
Then we actually made new technology, and this included things like a flamethrower that where you could not only see it in virtual reality and you could hear it, but it heated up in your hand. So there were electronics that made it get hotter or colder in your hand.
McGuire says MIT, Stanford, and European universities are also pushing virtual reality. He says sporting events are likely the next virtual reality experience to be available to the masses. Companies like Google and Sony are developing VR products, some of which a person can have in their home for hundreds of dollars or less. McGuire says the New York Times is even experimenting with VR. In fact, the first presidential debate was available in a 360-degree virtual reality view.
The notion of journalism and nonfiction forms in VR is essential because when we show you a regular documentary, there's a huge level of editing, hiding the camera crew off screen. If I'm showing you a picture of a protester clashing with a riot police officer, you have a very different impression if you see hundreds more people having those conflicts outside the frame versus if you realize, hey, that's an isolated incident and there are people walking past with baby carriages just outside the frame.
Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Lavoulis.
Still to come, a new museum exhibit celebrates the teenager who invented science fiction back in 1818. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A new exhibit in Minneapolis's Bakken Museum explores the genius behind Frankenstein, the 1818 novel written by a teenager. That teenager, of course, was Mary Shelley, the author of a story that continues to resonate with people throughout the world. From station KFAI, Will Wright reports.
Enter the new Mary and Her Monster exhibit at Minneapolis's Bakken Museum, and it may startle you, as it did me.
You were completely startled. Seeing that movement just completely disturbed you. The way you jumped was great.
My being startled made the Bakken's curator, Juliet Burba, giddy. What fooled me was a portrait of Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, the 1818 novel that shook the world, and still does. For more than a decade, the Bakken Museum showed its Frankenstein laboratory. Now it's commemorating the author, the teenage girl who wrote the first science fiction novel, Beginning It All. Why do this exhibit now at the Bakken Museum? I mean, you already have the Frankenstein's laboratory.
There's a couple of reasons to do it now. We are on the 200-year anniversary of when Frankenstein was written. And so Mary Shelley began it in the summer of 1816, and then it was published in 1818. So we, in essence, have 2 years now to celebrate the bicentennial. But also, we've had this very popular exhibit, the Frankenstein Object Theater, that tells the story. But we wanted to tell the story of the woman behind that story. She was 18 when she started writing Frankenstein. And so it's a fascinating story when you think about an 18-year-old in 1816 writing this story that we still use as a metaphor.
Why not let the portrait describe how Mary began? Just imagine a large wall photo turning toward and talking to you.
The weather was terrible and we spent many hours inside talking. We also read ghost stories. One evening Lord Byron said each of us should write our own ghost story. I busied myself thinking of a story to rival the ones we had been reading. Could I make a reader like you dread to look around? Perhaps a corpse could be reanimated using electricity.
Why come to an exhibit about the teenager that wrote the first science fiction novel?
I think it might be the chance to figure out, you can take some quizzes, some interactive quizzes, and you can figure out how you might relate to aspects of Mary's personality.
How about the creatures?
You know, we didn't explore that, but certainly after you've explored her world, you can go next door and hear that story in the Object Theater.
Referring to Frankenstein's laboratory at the Bakken.
Now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart.
We'll be reopening that because these two exhibits will work so nicely together.
The best-known clips of the monster have a being that speaks in grunts. One facet of Mary and her monster has examples of books that the former read. The book gives us a creature that, while grotesque, is articulate and well-read. About these books...
If you look at the list of books that she read just around the time that she was working on this, you can see she read immense amounts of literature. She read books on science, poetry, history. And so, in a way, the monster reflects her.
Which raises an interesting, perhaps prickly question of to what extent was it an alter ego for her?
I know that scholars have proposed that that is indeed the case, that she saw it in that way. Perhaps it is in part an alter ego for her.
Each of us likes a great scare, ideally on our own terms. This exhibit shows that Mary created a universal emblem of the other, her monster, that affected generations, and still does.
And that story comes to us from Will Wright of Station KFAI. Well, the next time you're about to yoink out some daylilies or something, you might want to think twice. Losing perennial plants can hurt the environment. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The loss of perennial plants hurts an environment. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Andrew Van Lucke, assistant professor in the Department of Agronomy at Iowa State University, explores strategies involving annuals and perennials to improve soil.
As societies and technologies have developed, the ways we use the sun's energy to grow crops has dramatically expanded. So has the expectation that we produce energy in ways that have minimal impacts on the environment. Many of the acres that are in cropland today were once home to perennial plant species, predominantly grasses, shrubs, and trees. These perennials form nutrient-rich, self-sustaining ecosystems that lasted millennia. However, the vast majority of crops produced today are annual species, like corn and soybean. These have provided us with great resources and opportunities, but in the annual system, it is difficult to synchronize the timing of nutrient availability and uptake by plants. This leads to challenges in retaining soil and nutrients in the field. One research-supported strategy is to integrate more perennial plants into current cropping systems. Perennial ecosystems have many characteristics that make them beneficial as bioenergy feedstocks, and their ability to prevent nutrient losses are an added ecosystem service. My research has assessed how transitioning some of the cropland in the Mississippi River Basin into perennial crops would impact regional water quality. We have developed a model to simulate two perennial grasses used to produce biofuels, miscanthus and switchgrass, using regional soil, climate, and the cropland data. The model indicates that in some locations, nitrogen losses went down by more than 70%. These decreases in lost nutrients have a direct benefit to the quality of water that eventually reaches the Gulf of Mexico. Our results suggest that perennials should have a predominant place in our portfolio of strategies to address crop production and environmental needs. Also, our scenarios illustrate what's physically possible, but do not include important social and economic factors that will have a major impact on any future outcome. Like most complicated scientific challenges, we do not have a silver bullet in perennial bioenergy crops. Instead, we have more evidence of a promising strategy that can contribute to an important local, regional, and national issue.
That was Andrew Van Lucke of Iowa State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.